It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
It is Rico Bronya time. Welcome to episode 731, recorded in the wee hours of 731. It's like a happy coincidence. Episode 731 on what I like to call the old MLB trade deadline. I know for some of our older listeners, June 15th was the trade deadline. That to me is just something I heard about in history. You know, Tom Seaver being traded, Keith Hernandez being acquired. But my entire like childhood and early adult life had it as July 31st. It never varied. And over the last couple of years, it's varied based on, I really don't know. I don't know if MLB prefers to avoid weekends or avoid Friday nights, but it changes. It's not July 31st universally. Sometimes, like in 2026, it can be August 3rd. But we are doing this, Rico Bronya, at least recording it for those that are consuming it live on YouTube. How are you? And for those downloading the Rico Bronya, wherever you download your podcast, we are recording the Rico on the last half hour of July 31st. And I also remember the trade deadline being at midnight. So I almost look at this Rico Bronya as like we're honoring history. Midnight, July 31st. And then somewhere along the lines that changed to where it's 6 o'clock. And then obviously it's not universally July 31st. So here's what we're going to do on this Rico Bronya. So you can decide if you actually want to listen or not, or fast forward, or do whatever the hell you want to do. Maybe listen to Giants talk on One Giant Step with Sean Moresh. We will talk a little bit about the first two games of the Marlins series. I happen to go to both games, so we'll break it down Rico style. But we will begin with the trade deadline, including the one trade that was consummated so far as of the time of this recording, and that was AJ Minter being dealt away to the Minnesota Twins for two prospects. And really the headliner is the fact that Benny Agbayani has a son who is a prospect and is now a member of the New York Mets. I was not familiar with Bruin Agbayani. And so it was news to me. But when I saw that AJ Minter was traded, and that's the first thing I saw, traded to Minnesota, my first reaction was, sure. I mean, there's no way that AJ Minter was going to survive the trade deadline. And then before I looked at the prospects, who I knew I wasn't going to be familiar with, but where they're ranked organizationally, what positions they play, their stats, and then doing some more legwork to find out who these people are, I had a very low bar. So I didn't go into the return for AJ Minter thinking it was going to be anything crazy, because here's the reality of AJ Minter. While he's pitched mostly well this season, he's made 23 appearances, and I would just guess off the top of my head his first 13 were really good, and he's been more human over his last 8 to 10 appearances. This is a guy who's been here for 2 years, and while his overall numbers as a Met are actually pretty good, like his overall Met ERA is incredibly low, he was never healthy. I mean, I think of AJ Minter, if I'm ever going to talk about his legacy, which I doubt I would say he was here for 2 years. He made $11 million and then a little bit more than $11 million when you think about the prorated nature of this season. So the Mets probably paid him, giving you a rough estimate, let's say $18 million over the last 2 years. And he made 39 appearances. He barely pitched. That's the reality. He barely pitched in 2025. He got hurt early in the season, was out for the season. So his impact was limited. And you almost forgot he existed because he got hurt so early in the 25 season that as the season hit its apex and then collapsed, he had nothing to do with it. He comes back this year after missing the first month. And if you look at the way the Mets used AJ Minter, despite his mostly good numbers, he wasn't routinely used in high leverage situations. And a part of that was the Met bullpen was good. You have Luke Weaver, you have Brooks Raley, you have Devin Williams as your closer. And so the depth of the Met bullpen and the fact that Minter had missed so much time almost combined for the fact that he was not used as an $11 million a year reliever. He wasn't. He was not used frequently in high leverage situations. And so a part of why I didn't have a high bar for what they would get back was the salary. He's making $11 million. The unreliability of the fact that he has missed so much time, not just the last 2 years, but even if you want to go back further to his year with Atlanta, the final year of his Atlanta run, he missed the last month and a half of the season. So you're talking about a guy who's got a long injury track record. And I think when you glance at the other relievers that are available, even the ones the Mets are planning on trading, they have more value. So when I saw what the return is, Bruin Agbayani and Billy Amick, who, like most of us, we had to look up. It's not like we're experts on the Minnesota Twins farm system. I wasn't disappointed because I didn't expect that much more. And I tried to make this warning on the last couple of Ricos. Certainly on the last edition of the Rico Bronya, I very quickly went through the history of the Mets selling. And I also reminded people that you usually don't do that well when you're selling pieces off. Now, are there examples of great sell-offs, not just in Met history, but in recent baseball history? Of course, you're always going to find some exceptions. Obviously, we're still living with the fact that one of the big miscues in terms of the way guys turned into players was the Javi Baez PCA trade. And there's no question that that's an all-timer. No one can deny that, even if you want to defend the thinking of the Mets organization at the time. And the thing I always bring up that people forget, and that was the fact that Javi Baez was actually good. He didn't come here and hit 215. It's almost like we remember it differently because of the thumbs down and because the nature of the Mets just losing a lot of games. They did not play well after the Baez trade. But Javier Baez, for the 6 or 7 weeks he was a New York Met, put up really good numbers, put up some of the best numbers of his career. But I'm not defending it. Pedro Armstrong is proving to be a perennial MVP candidate. So that is a prime example over the last couple of years in terms of the impact of a trade deadline deal. And if you want to go back further in terms of our history, Carlos Beltran for Zach Wheeler. But those are exceptions. And when you're talking about a guy like AJ Minter, who I just laid out has missed a lot of time over the last few years, was not being used in high leverage situations, it is tough to expect that the return is going to be great. Now, here's the beauty of baseball. Let's take Billy Amick as an example. He's 23 years old. He's a right-handed slugger. He was a second-round pick of the Minnesota Twins 2 seasons ago. And when you check his numbers this year at Double-A Wichita, there's a couple of things that jump out at you. He hits for a very low batting average, but he's got a lot of pop. The guy's hit 23 home runs in 86 games. That's pretty impressive. Low batting average, 108 strikeouts, and 850 OPS. The odds are very low that he's going to be an impact major leaguer. There's a chance he's Eric Wagaman, right? Just a right-handed bat who maybe gets a cup of coffee at the major league level, but never turns in to a star. But it's a lottery ticket. That's what a lot of these trades are. Billy Amick, I use him as that example, is a lottery ticket. He's a 23-year-old slugger at AA who very well may not make the major leagues. But if you have a choice between AJ Minter just pitching out the rest of this meaningless season with the Mets versus, hey, let's get 2 lottery tickets. They're not top 100 prospects. They're not even top 10 prospects in the Twins organization. What would you rather do? And the answer is you take the lottery ticket. So that's Billy Amick. That's your quick breakdown. He's in Double-A. He's a first baseman. He's got a lot of power. I don't know if we'll ever see him at the major league level. Maybe he turns into just a righty bat off the bench. And by the way, let's say that's the case. Let's say Billy Amick turns in to a right-handed bat off the bench who gives you some slug against left-handed pitching. And he does that with the Mets. It was a good trade. It really is, because you traded a reliever who's making $11 million, who's barely pitched the last 2 years. And if you turn that into either of these guys getting to the major leagues and not even being a starter, like, that's where the bar is so different. You know, you draft a guy in the first round like Michael Conforto. Many Met fans look at Michael Conforto's career and say, hey, that was a disappointment. Brett Beatty, that's a disappointment. If Billy Amick turns in either one of those guys, we would consider, or I would consider, hey, this trade was a good one. As far as Bruin Agbayani is concerned, I stereotyped. I did, because I think of Benny. And Benny was a beloved Met, as this short, chunky, got some pop in his right-handed bat outfielder. So I hear it, the Mets acquired his son. I'm assuming it's Benny Agbayani Jr. And I find out he's 6'2", 185. So not exactly the build of Benny. He hits left-handed, so hits completely different than Benny, and he's a middle infielder. So that was exciting. I also find out he's out for the season, so that's a little disappointing. And when he played, in the brief time he played, it was at single A. So Bruin Agbayani, a 19-year-old kid, who I guess you could be excited about because his dad was a beloved Met, is also a lottery ticket, probably more so a lottery ticket because of his age and how far away he is from the major leagues. If Bruin Agbayani ever turns into any kind of major leaguer, he's probably not seeing the major leagues until, want to say, 2029. That's a fair guess. So that's a lottery ticket, much like the David Robertson trade from 2023, where we may not see the results for a while. Do I like the trade, right? That's a clear reaction every time a trade is made. Do you like it? I don't like it. I don't hate it. It was just necessary. AJ Minter needed to be off this roster. Keeping him on this roster as a 33-year-old left-handed reliever who's a free agent at the end of the year would have been a waste of time. If neither of these guys make the major leagues, we'll forget this trade ever occurred. Much like all the sell-off moves that the Mets made in 2017 or 2018. We don't remember them because when they sold off Curtis Granderson and they sold off Lucas Duda and they sold off those Neil Walker and the remnants of the 15-16 unit, we thought lottery tickets. And honestly, only one guy ended up hitting as a lottery ticket. And no one in their right mind would say it was a success, and that's Drew Smith. Because who thinks of Drew Smith in any positive way? But he made the major leagues. And when you're dumping the likes of Lucas Duda and Neil Walker and Curtis Granderson, what the hell do you expect? So do I like the trade? It's tough to like or hate anything, especially with this player. Now, it's different. When you talk about Clay Holmes, it'll be different when we talk about Luke Weaver because then the expectations on the return are going to be higher. That will be different. Let me read an email about the AJ Minter trade. We'll mix in emails throughout this edition of the Rico. This is from Zach who writes, Evan, I'm beyond frustrated about David Stearns and here's why. We traded AJ Minter for two prospects in the Twins farm system ranked 29th and 21st. Yes, AJ Minter is a rental. However, look at what we traded for Tyler Rogers last year. We gave up Blake Tidwell, number 10 prospect, Drew Gilbert, number 14 in our system, and Jose Buteau. Stearns got fleeced whether he's buying or selling. Well, let's examine that for a second. So when the Mets traded for Tyler Rogers, I was excited because he's a good, reliable reliever, and I thought he improved the Mets' bullpen. And I was taken back slightly. I remember saying it on the Rico and on WFAN by how much they gave up. Like, it did seem like a lot when you think about Blake Tidwell, a guy who we saw in the major leagues briefly. Drew Gilbert, who was the key piece to the Justin Verlander trade, and even a major leaguer like Jose Buteau. So it did feel like it was an expensive return. You want to call that a fleecing? Drew Gilbert is what right now? Jose Buteau is what right now? And Blake Tidwell, I wanted to check in on what he did. He made a handful of appearances out of the bullpen for the Giants, but he's been pitching in AAA to a 4.5 ERA. You want to call that a fleecing? Did Tyler Rogers work out for the Mets? No, he wasn't bad. He was probably the best of the acquisitions that David Stearns made. And it seemed like the soft contact would always get to him. But I can't look at what the Mets gave up with a year retrospect. And obviously there's more time. I mean, Drew Gilbert could still turn into a superstar. He had brief moments of success last season, but would anybody really call that a fleecing? I can't call that a fleecing. Let's see what Drew Gilbert's up to this year. In 85 games at the major league level, a .237 batting average and a .679 OPS. He's also spent time at AAA in Sacramento. Only 11 games, but at AAA Sacramento, .289, .789 OPS. fleecing. He's also now 25 years old. Is he? And he's about to turn 26 next month or in a month and a half. Is that a prospect? Is that a guy who's probably going to be at best a fourth outfielder? Blake Tidwell, I just mentioned, is floundering at AAA. And we all knew what Jose Buto was when they traded him. We were all pretty much done with him, and he's been injured this year and has missed a huge chunk of time. He had only made three appearances this season and gave up five runs in two innings. So that was not a fleecing. In fact, that's a great example. I'm glad you wrote the email. That was a return we thought was expensive. And think about what it is. Now, as far as why on paper did you get more for Tyler Rogers than the Mets got for AJ Minter, I think the answer is very simple on that. Tyler Rogers is a lot better. Like I mentioned, AJ Minter comes with unreliability issues or reliability issues. Tyler Rogers, and I said this when the Mets acquired him and about the Mets potentially signing him as a free agent this season, like bringing him back. One of the most appealing things about Tyler Rogers, and it's very rare, is that the guy goes out and pitches. Like, he leads the league in appearances on a year-by-year basis and pitches really, really well. And he's doing it this year for Toronto. He has a 1.69 ERA in 50 appearances for the Toronto Blue Jays. Crazy. Before he got traded to the Mets, he had 53 appearances and pitched to a 1.80 ERA. So I appreciate the email, but I disagree on every level. A, the Mets didn't get fleeced for Tyler Rogers, at least as of right now. And B, Tyler Rogers is a lot better. When we get to Weaver and we get to even Clay Holmes as a starting pitcher, that's where I have higher expectations on what the returns are. But even then, and let's move on to Luke Weaver. There has been linkage to the Pittsburgh Pirates as a team that's very hot for him. I still have a very tough time believing that the Mets are walking away from this entire trade deadline, and this includes Weaver, Holmes, Peralta, by adding a top 100 prospect. Like, I don't see that happening. I hope it happens. It'd be exciting, but I don't think that's going to happen. In fact, if you look back at last season, last year's trade deadline, and you can fact check me on this, but only two top 100 prospects were moved at the trade deadline. And I want to remind you who they were for. Yoan Duran to the Philadelphia Phillies. The Phillies sent back one top 100 prospect. And obviously Mason Miller, in which Leo DeVries, one of the top prospects in all of baseball, went back to the A's. Well, Mason Miller and Yoan Duran are two of the best relievers in the sport and had team control. I don't think, as much as I would love for it to be the case, that any of the pieces the Mets are selling have the value that those two guys had at the trade deadline. Young guys, top elite level closers, prime of their career with team control. And based on my quick research, and again, I'm welcome to be fact checked. I'm sure our archivist Dan will. Those are the only top 100 prospects that have been traded. So we need to temper our expectations. I'll do a science experiment. Pete Hoffman has been negative about everything. He probably also doesn't want to comment on his guy, Harrison Bader, who's in a he's in a heap of trouble for, I guess, another scooter incident. Apparently, he had one in college. But I asked Pete Hoffman, who is somehow simultaneously hosting a radio show while producing the Rico Bronya, which is why there's like a 30% chance he may not respond to me right now. Hoff, did you like the trade of AJ Minter? Now, he's not responding, but my defense of him is, again, he's hosting a show while all of this happens, which is very, very impressive. Let me read another trade-related email. This is not a trade for right now. This would be more for the offseason. But Ari in Bayside writes, I wanted a quick thoughts on what you would think a trade for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. would look like. Mets get their first baseman, and Toronto might be willing to go for it, given a down year in the nature of the contract. Let me know your thoughts. I doubt the Blue Jays, a year off a championship or an American League championship, not a world championship, though it should have been, and a year off of giving Vlad that contract, I don't think they'd be in a rush to move him. I think Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is a lifelong Toronto Blue Jay. But interesting idea considering the Blue Jays are leaning towards selling. Now, my expectations for this trade deadline, it is not to get a top 100 prospect, but I look at Clay Holmes and I feel like his return should be the best. And maybe that's crazy considering the resume of Freddy Peralta, but Clay Holmes has looked so good as a starting pitcher and was so locked in prior to the line drive off of his leg by Spencer Jones that I would think contending teams are going to be hot to trot for him. The other thing that has to be very appealing about both Freddy Peralta and Clay Holmes is that even if you're a small market team, and granted they're free agents at the end of the year, but still paying a guy's salary is a question. Like, we had the news earlier today or on Friday that the Brewers would be willing to pay the remainder of Tarik Skubal's contract. Not all teams are. I don't know if the Tampa Bay Rays would be. Well, the beauty of Peralta and Holmes is that their salaries, even on a prorated basis, are incredibly low for good starting pitchers. Freddy Peralta was only making $8 million this year, which is nothing for a starting pitcher. Clay Holmes was making $12 million, and we know why. Because when the Mets signed him, he was a converted reliever, in which none of us had any idea what he would be as a starting pitcher. So I think along with the fact that Holmes looked so good prior to his injury, and Peralta at least has the resume prior to being a Met, you would think those returns should be really good. And you got a lot of teams interested. There were reports on Friday that the Braves are hot, the Phillies are hot. Basically, everybody is interested in Freddy Peralta. And what I said 2 weeks ago, and it was more speculative and just observing Peralta throughout 2026, was that I look at Freddy and I say, how much of this is on the Mets? I've seen it before where guys struggle with certain teams, not because of the pressure of the media or the fans, but because the coaching staff just does a terrible job with them. And even though we're only a year and a half removed from waxing poetic about the Mets pitching lab, is the lab kind of reversed? Is it like, as Joe B. once said, the Wuhan lab from COVID? Because we've seen David Peterson go to Chicago, and outside of one horrendous start that's going to ruin his stats, he's been really good. We've seen guys go backwards here. And so I brought that up a few weeks ago. And now there have been reports that that's the way the league views Peralta. That a lot of teams say the Mets have screwed him up. Now, here's the good news and the bad news with that thing. If that's true, the good news is, hey, the Mets could still get a great return. Hey, they won't get two top 100 prospects like they got when they, or like they gave up when they traded for him. But maybe they can recoup 70% on value of the assets they lost, or 60% of the assets on value that they lost. And that's surprising considering how horrific Peralta's been this season. So that's the good news, that if enough teams are A, interested in him, and B, believe this is the Mets' fault and that he's not damaged goods, the Mets could do well on the return. Here's the real problem, the concerning problem. If the Mets effed up Freddy Peralta, why did it happen? And what is the grinning genius going to do to change that in the future? Because he's been called out numerous times by some of the New York media with questions about the coaching staff doing a bad job, and it has. I don't know how anyone could dispute it. And David has said, coaching staff's done a great job. Has it? I mean, when you have a season like this, everyone's done a crappy job, like from top to bottom. Jorge Polanco cannot be this bad, yet he is this bad. That's on Jorge Polanco. It's on David Stearns thinking he was a fine replacement for Pete Alonso at first base, or even an offensive replacement for Brandon Nimmo, which is the way I viewed it during the offseason. But also to have guys go backwards, especially pitchers, you have to reevaluate what you're doing. Freddy Peralta is not a bad guy. Freddy Peralta is a really good guy. Freddy Peralta said all the right things since he's been here. No one dislikes Freddy Peralta because of him as a person. We're all disappointed that he has sucked as a New York Met. And it was cool to see him on Friday night, despite being scratched, despite clearly being traded and being a former Met within hours. It was cool to see him still take Nolan McClain and Christian Scott under his wing. I say all this to say, when Freddy Peralta gets traded inevitably, for my own mental sake, I don't want him to pitch well. And I set that up because it's nothing personal. Freddie seems like a great guy. Again, he has done nothing wrong. Nothing wrong in terms of off the field. He's done everything wrong on the field. But you guys know what I mean. Like, there's no ill will towards Freddie Peralta. It has not worked. But the reason I got to root against him is if this guy goes anywhere else and just turns into the old Freddie Peralta, we are going to be left looking around saying, what the hell is wrong with this franchise? What are we doing wrong that's ruining pitchers? And as soon as they leave, it's all fine. So I admit it, whether it's Atlanta or it's Milwaukee or wherever Freddie Peralta ends up, I personally do not care where he's traded. I want the best return on prospects. If it's the Atlanta Braves, spare me. It doesn't matter. With guys who are free agents at the end of the year, just get me the best return. That's where I'm at. So I don't even care if it's the Phillies, the Braves, or if it's in another league. It does not matter to me. Plus, we don't have an emotional attachment to him. So I remember with Beltran, it was different because for those that recall, the Braves were very hot for Carlos Beltran when the Mets eventually traded him to San Francisco. And it was a debate on the air in terms of the Phillies, too. It was both of them, the Phillies and the Braves. Would we want to see Carlos with one of those teams? And I still, at the end of the day, said, just get me the best return. Dominic Brown was the Phillies' top prospect, and I think he was one of the rumored names. I forget who was linked with Atlanta, but Dom Brown was definitely one of them. Obviously, that wouldn't have worked. Not nearly as good as Zach Wheeler. But while it would have been tough to see Beltran, who I liked as a Met, beloved maybe too strong, but I liked him as a Met. He did create a connection with me as a fan. I didn't want to see him in Atlanta, but at the end of the day, I still viewed the return as the most important thing. None of us have any attachment to any of the players the Mets are going to trade at the deadline, assuming it remains the guys who are rumored. Freddie Peralta, he's going to go down in Met history as just the answer to a trivia question. Luke Weaver is David Robertson all over again. David Robertson was really good as a Met for a period of time. It was not his fault that the 2023 team underachieved. And ultimately, once the Mets decided we're pulling the plug, we don't think we're any good, they were smart to trade him. And if you recall, when he was traded to the Marlins, he fell off a cliff. Like, the Mets had used him so much that he didn't have a lot left in the final few months of the season. But Luke Weaver is David Robertson. If the Mets trade him, I don't have an emotional attachment to him. So it is much easier than the case of Carlos Beltran to say, just go to the highest bidder. Now, let's get some thoughts on the first two games of this series against the Miami Marlins. I happen to go to both of them. Thursday was a last-second decision. I think most season ticket holders are aware of the quandary I have, which is that nobody wants to buy tickets. The Met value right now is incredibly low. And so on Thursday, I wasn't planning on going. Had no intention of going. The traffic was very, very bad, but I still had two of my tickets. When the rain started and the rain delay began, I turned over, looked over at my son, my oldest son. I said, "Wait, you want to just get in the car and go?" And he thought it was the coolest adventure. So at about 7:30, with the rain delay beginning, we got in the car. We went, missed the first inning because they ended up starting this game at 8:16. So walked in right as Bo Bichette was flying out to end the bottom of the first inning. But no biggie. I've learned, I give Tommy Lugauer a lot of credit for this, as much as his positivity has driven some Met fans to drink. Tommy would always bust my balls and say, "Who cares if you miss the first pitch? There will always be a second pitch and a third pitch." And it was a douchey line, but it's so true. And I was forced while I was doing afternoons to sometimes miss the first pitch or miss the first two innings sometimes based on time of show. And so I kind of got used to missing the first batter of a game. I still don't like it. It's not something I prefer. But on a spur of the moment Thursday night call that me and my son made, it was okay. So I missed Nolan McLean fighting through the first inning, but eventually striking out Heriberto Hernandez to get through that first inning. Nolan McLean again. Impressive. He was not dominant. I think at times last season we saw dominance from Nolan McLean. I don't think we've seen a lot of that, even as he's turned his season around. But he makes the big pitch when he needs to. He gets out of the first inning with two on, two out. gets the pickoff of Graham Pauley in the second inning, overcomes his own error when he tried to pick off Xavier Edwards and threw it away by striking out Otto Lopez. The mistake he made was the home run to Kyle Stowers. I think it was a sweeper right in the middle of the plate, and he crushed it. Now, I got to hand it to Andy Green. And I can never prove this, so hopefully there's a trust here on the Rico that I'm not one to say I thought something and then it's proven true and I'm just trying to make myself feel better, because I will many, many times admit when I'm wrong, even when I don't have to. Like, hey, I thought this in the midst of the game and it turned out to be very, very wrong. So again, I'm at this game. I don't hear the commentators. I'm just watching. It's the seventh inning. At this point, the Mets had just taken a 2-1 lead. Obviously, McClain gave up a home run to Kyle Stowers, and the Mets came back. Francisco Lindor, RBI single, and then a huge error by Graham Pauley when Luis Robert Jr. was going to ground out the end of the inning, and the Mets get gifted a second run. They go up 2-1. It's the seventh inning. McClain's at 85 pitches, no-brainer to keep him in this game. He strikes out Griffin Conine. And before Andy Green ever made a comment after the game, I was surprised by the emotion McClain showed on the strikeout. I was, because I've said numerous times here on the Rico when we talk about taking a pitcher out, that sometimes the reaction that a pitcher has ending an inning will tell you if they're done or not. We've said that many times about the young guys, not necessarily about veterans, though. Sometimes it applies. So we've seen this with McClain, where he'll get the last out of the sixth inning. He'll show an incredible amount of emotion. And my feeling has been, more this season, get him out. Even if his pitch count is reasonably low, even if I think he can still get more guys out, if he's showing you with that emotion, that kind of reaction, he's almost telling you in a lot of ways, I've just left it all out there. I'm done. I got nothing else. So I was surprised that McClain reacted that way. Think about how the rest of the inning goes. It's a 2-1 game, so you have very little margin for error. And I'm not blaming Andy Green for not taking him out. It was more just, wow, McClain really gave a pumped up reaction to that Griffin Conine strikeout. He falls behind Jacob Marcy 3-0. And then grooves a fastball right down the middle that Marcy crushes for a game-tying home run. And then he gives up the base hit right after that to Graham Pauley. No-brainer again, Andy Green says, okay, gave you a chance to start the seventh. You got the first out. You gave up back-to-back hits. It's a 2-2 game with one out. I'm going to take you out. I'm going to go to Brooks Raley. Which made sense. No issue with that. But Andy Green was right to call McClain out after the game. And we've seen Andy Green now do this a couple of times with young pitchers, the Christian Scott thing about needing to be more aggressive. But if I thought the same thing from my seat in the 300 level, then I'm glad Andy Green noticed the same thing. I couldn't have been alone on that, especially because I think if you haven't thought the way I've thought with this, or listen to the Rico, I get saying, what are you talking about? The guy showed emotion. He's not allowed to show emotion. I have no problem with guys showing emotion. I'm not against guys showing emotion. But I have used this season as a guide on when a pitcher is done or not. And so if you just agree with that, if you just say, yeah, you know what? I understand that. Then wouldn't you have the same reaction, especially with the results of what happened next with Nolan McClain? So it's a sign that that is a fair way to view pitchers and when they should come in and out of games or come out of games. But good job by Andy Green. That doesn't mean I want to bring him back as manager next year, by the way. Don't take any compliment of Andy Green as, oh, Evan's coming around. He wants to hire him. No, I do not. But I think as a player development guy, as someone who's in the front office and will have a voice in this organization, even after they hire a real manager or a regular manager, I agreed with that sentiment because I thought that sentiment while sitting there at Citi Field. Good job by Brooks Raley, though. Got a little lucky, got a little line out double play, got through the eighth inning after a leadoff hit. And then we get the moment in the eighth inning where the Mets begin a two-out, nobody-on rally with an 0-2 double by Bo Bichette. This is such baseball. And if I was a Marlin fan who came into this game 55-54, two games out of a wild card spot, the way the eighth inning rolled with Michael Peterson on the mound would have just pissed me off to no end. Two outs, nobody on, ahead of Bo Bichette 0-2, double to right field. Base hit to Carson Benj, where Bichette has to hold up at third, and he was smart to hold up at third because he wasn't going to be able to score. And then Luis Robert Jr., behind in the count, hits a ground ball to third base that just finds the right spot for a two-run single. That is a bad loss for them. For us, we're like, ah, cool win. That's where we are with this season. It's like, ah, that was fun. I got a nice little victory. Devin Williams makes it stand up in the ninth inning. In fact, the way I feel about this team, and this is a great email I want to read from Josh. It's a long email, but I want you to listen to it because I think he really nails a lot of Met fans' views, at least the Met fans still watching games. I totally get, and I know that we have some listeners and viewers who are not watching this team at all, and they're like, oh, I'll just check in on what that schmuck is saying on the Rico, and maybe that'll keep me posted. But there are some diehards that are watching every pitch the way I am, the way a lot of the Ricoers are, and I thought Josh did a great job. He writes, Evan and Hoff, maybe something is wrong with me, but I still watch every single night, and I honestly think I'm enjoying the Mets now more than I did in April, May, and June. Back then, every game felt like a referendum on the season. Every loss was crushing. Every underperforming veteran made you wonder how a team with all this talent and payroll could look so lifeless. Now, the pressure is gone. As strange as it sounds, these dead Mets remind me of 2004. Once the season was effectively over, nobody was obsessing with the wild card or the standings anymore. David Wright came up. Jose Reyes was finally healthy. And instead of watching a team fail to meet expectations, we got to watch the foundation of the next great Mets team being built. That's where we are now. I'm not rooting for losses. I still love this team for whatever irrational reason Mets fans always do. But I'd rather spend August watching the next homegrown core get meaningful opportunities than watching the front office convince itself one more veteran can rescue a lost season. History tells us the Mets are at their best when homegrown stars become the foundation and veterans are brought in to complement them, not the other way around. The best part of these dead Mets isn't hope, it's the absence of dread. Am I the only sicko who feels that way? Josh. I won't agree that I enjoy this more because I'd still rather be in a pennant race. So that's the only part that I would disagree with. Last season was torture. No doubt. But we always had hope that they could make the playoffs and then get hot at the right time. So even until the very bitter end, even until that final Sunday when Francisco Lindor bounced into a double play, the games mattered and you were able to dream, just get in. And anything can happen. So I'd rather have that, even if looking back on 2025, it was a tooth extraction for 4.5 months. So that part I'll disagree with, but I do agree that watching this team right now it's free from dread. You're right. Like I'm there Friday, and we'll get into game two of this series in a second. And Jorge Polanco sucking doesn't piss me off to the level of what it would do if this team was two games out of a wild card spot. And when the Mets lose a game the way they did on Friday after winning on Thursday, I'd be in a horrible mood. I'm not in a horrible mood. I rather they win, but it doesn't affect me in the same way. So from that standpoint, I do agree with you. But let me tell you, as painful as pennant races are, as horrible as it is when a team doesn't meet expectations, I'd rather be playing meaningful games than watching this, even if this no longer supplies stress. Right, game two of this series was on Friday. I went to this one. It was fireworks night. By the way, the fireworks were awesome. I thought the fireworks at the end of Mets Marlins Friday, July 31st was the best fireworks they've had this season. They had like a big ending that was kind of cool. My one critique is the theme of the fireworks was 1986, Makes sense. They're honoring the 86 team over the weekend. So they played music from 1986, and yet they didn't play Let's Go Mets Go. We got the teamwork to make a dream work. Let's go. How do you not do that? That doesn't make any sense to me. Like, you're playing 86 music. Cool. Totally get the theme. Why not play a song that I have to admit all these years later is a great song? I remember in the late 90s when the Mets returned to relevance and goodness, I would always ask my dad, why don't they bring that song back? You know, maybe rewrite some of the words, but why can't Let's Go, Mets Go, be New York, the Knicks song? We are the New York Knicks. Go New York, go New York, go. Like, that's a song from the 90s, and I think we all still think of it as the John Starks, Charles Oakley, Patrick Ewing Knicks, and yet you still hear it at Madison Square Garden. So, I don't know, whatever. That's just a critique I have. As far as the game was concerned, the Mets decided to scratch Freddie Peralta. Completely agree with it. Why risk? Nothing in his start can enhance his value. Not a damn thing. He could pitch a 27 up, 27 down, perfect game. Obviously, he's not capable of that. But even that wouldn't change his value. So if the value isn't going to be enhanced, the only thing that could happen is negativity. He could get hurt. And if he gets hurt and he becomes a sunk cost, that's a disaster. So Mets made the right choice by scratching him. They decide to give the start to Kodai Senga, which made me laugh when I saw it. They also lost Siono Perez to the injured list, which sucks for him. He actually has pitched well out of the bullpen. So the Mets added Jonathan Pantaro and Xavion Curry made his return. So two guys on the Syracuse shuttle came back. And Kodai Senga was shockingly brilliant. Shockingly brilliant. He was efficient as all hell. I couldn't believe the pitch counts. He was at 29 pitches through three. Then he goes out and throws a four-pitch fourth inning to have a pitch count of 33 through four innings, which I haven't seen from anybody at all this season. And the entire time, like, it wasn't just he was lucky. You know, he was good. He was getting swing and misses. He struck out one in the first, two in the second, one in the third, worked through a one-out double by Joe Mack in the third inning. He was really, really good. And then the fifth inning came. Now, the fifth inning was also what I like to call Kitty Field inning. Me and my youngest son, I switch off sons that I take to games. That's my strategy. It's how I keep it fresh for them. Oldest, youngest. So my youngest, Spence, was with me, and we have to do Kitty Field. He still loves it. Got to meet the mascots at the mascot race, which is always fun. And he just lost it, Senga, in the fifth inning. I was watching this on the big screen that they have at Kitty Field, which is very cool. And look, I want to give Senga like a B for his outing, because he also hasn't started in a while. Ultimately, his pitching line ends up looking like Freddie Peralta, minus the pitch count, four innings, three runs. I mean, that is a Freddie Peralta line if I've ever seen one. The only part of the outing that was not Peralta-like was 49 pitches for Senga. Freddie would have been 95. But he just lost it. He lost his command. He walked Griffin Conine. He threw a wild pitch. He had a tough at-bat against Roberto Hernandez. He walked him. Then he gives up the RBI double to Jacob Marcy, and Andy Green was right to get him out of the game. So what's my takeaway from this? Do I keep Senga in the rotation? Like, I'm thinking about it out loud. I'd rather see young players. I think that's kind of the feeling of the last 2 months of the season. But you also need those young players to be ready. And it's tough to trust this organization right now. Their trust level is very low. But Jack Weninger, Jonah Tong, as much as, yeah, I'd rather see them pitch than Kodai Senga, they need to be ready. You need to feel like what's best for them is to be pitching at the major league level. And if it's not, then fine, we'll watch Kodai Senga. It was a great point made by an emailer a few weeks ago about Senga that you really can't DFA him, because why would you pay all the money for next season when there may not be a next season? So Senga kind of has to be here. You know, unless someone's taking his contract, which is not happening at the trade deadline, he sort of has to be here. So would you rather start him or use him out of the bullpen? If the young guys are ready, if you can tell me that it's best for the development of Tong or Wenninger to be here. I'd say Santucci, but it's not because he just got promoted to AAA, so not him. Then make him a short reliever. In fact, I lean towards doing that just to see what he can do in that role. The Mets are going to have a completely revamped bullpen by the time the trade deadline comes and goes. So I would kind of be intrigued by seeing Kodai Senga in that seventh or eighth inning role just to see how he does. But he made a good start. I mean, overall, it was decent. Four innings, 33 pitches, no runs, one hit, and then puts the first three guys on in the fifth inning. And unfortunately, Xavion Curry came in. He gives up the two-run single to Joe Mack. He gives up the RBI single to Xavier Edwards. And the Mets are down 4-0. They had opportunities, though. They had plenty of opportunities. Bottom of the fourth inning, they got a golden opportunity with a couple of guys on base, and Luis Robert Jr. struck out. But the fourth inning also featured something that I was very annoyed by, and I went back to the broadcast on my ride home. I wanted to listen to this, so I started before I got in the car the fourth inning, and it was very quick. And I wanted to hear what they said about the Lindor play. For those that didn't see it or you forgot, Francisco Lindor is on first base with one out. Bo Bichette hits a ground ball in the shortstop hole. Otto Lopez makes a throw to second, and Lindor runs through the bag, which guys are being taught to do, that you can get to the base quicker by running through it instead of sliding. The negative is if you're safe, like Lindor was, you're now off the bag. You can just be tagged out. So Lindor beats the throw, but he's rounding second base, or he was running through the bag, and at that point, he's now caught in dead man's land. So they execute a rundown. Lindor is not in the rundown long enough for Bichette to go to second, but he's out. As the geeky scorer, I'm not going to write it down, but I have an opinion, and my opinion is that's a base hit. Like, it is what it is. I didn't think there was an error by Otto Lopez. I know he hesitated in making the throw, but I didn't think it was enough of a bobble to call it an error, but it needs to be a hit because Lindor got the second base. They did not put a hit on the board. They called it a fielder's choice. It's the fourth inning, so I get there's a lot of time. And I thought to myself, boy, I tell you, the Marlins better not pitch a no-hitter because it will be BS. And maybe it will change, because sometimes these scoring decisions change. But in no world would that be a fielder's choice. So when I went back and listened to Gary, I knew Gary would talk about this. Like, most broadcasts would just be like, yeah, so Lindor ran through the bag, and more debate if he should have slid or not, which they did briefly. Gary Cohen, this is where I love the man. He was going to bring up the scoring decision. And he said the same thing. Well, I think he said it should have been an error, which is I completely disagree with, but it needed to be something. It can't be a field. What's the choice that Otto Lopez made? He made a throw to second. The guy was safe. That's not a fielder's choice. That's either a hit or an error. Now, luckily, Benge doubled on the next pitch, but I'm telling you, if the Mets got no hit, like if they didn't get another hit in this game, oh my God, I don't know what would have happened. Because they would need to change it. That is not a fielder's choice. That's a base hit. But I digress. Either way, my opinion on Lindor running through the bag, I get why guys do that. I actually do sort of agree with it, because you clearly slow down when you're sliding. And there's no guarantee Lindor is safe if he's sliding on that play. I think he would have been, but it would have been closer. So I get running through the bag, and you see the negative to it, though. You know, the Marlins could screw up the rundown. That's certainly possible. Or Lindor could have been in the rundown long enough for Bichette to get the second. None of that happened. But more scoring opportunities. Fifth inning, two outs and nobody on. And Kyle Stowers lets a ball go through his legs. Alvarez draws a four-pitch walk. A.J. Ewing drives in a run. Lindor rips a single. Unfortunately, Alvarez can't score from third. 4-1, bases loaded, two out. Here's Bo Bichette. Pops up to second base. For a guy who has a reputation or had a reputation of being incredibly clutch, he has not been a clutch Met. Just hasn't. And I know that July 31st with the Mets 16 games under 500 is probably not the prime example of not being clutch, but bases loaded, two out, he popped up. Had two guys on in the sixth inning, And Marcus Semien came up as a pinch hitter. Boy, he was a disaster. He struck out twice in this game. Jorge Polanco struck out. This game, the Friday game, game two of this series, between Semien in his last two at-bats and Polanco, this was disgusting. I mean, this was the epitome of the Stearns masterclass of the horrific nature of this offseason. I mean, Jorge Polanco is getting booed out of the building. And I'm not a booer, but after he, I think it was when he flew out in the ninth inning, I screamed, "You suck." That's my way of booing. I don't boo, but I will voice my displeasure. He is abysmal. I can't believe he's hit 135. He would have been better off not coming back from the IL. He would have been better off becoming Jed Lowry. Like, he's a rumor. Because you know why? Hear me out on this. If Jorge Polanco just misses the entire season with an Achilles, you could convince yourself, you know what? He had an injury-prone year. He's got even more time to recover with the lockout. He's going to have a big year. He'll bounce back. He'll be healthy. It's tougher to convince yourself of that when you watch him now every single day look like a minor league player. So he would have been better off just missing the entire year with the Achilles injury. He comes back. The only thing Polanco's good at is he wins his challenges. I'll give him that. I'll give him that. But he is horrific. And Marcus Semien, when he came off the bench, he struck out twice. Just awful. Luis Robert Jr., after getting the game-winning hit on Thursday, put together an 0-for-4, and he struck out his first three times up. He's coming up for the Golden Sombrero in the eighth inning with a runner on first, nobody out in a three-run game, and he bounces into a double play. The one time you're willing to wait and say, give me the strikeout, he bounces into a double play. Lindor had a good game, though. Drew Walk got a hit and hit a 9-pitch at-bat home run in the seventh inning that turned a 5-1 game into a 5-2 game. And then he had a cool moment. He hit his 150th home run as a Met, which had him pass Carlos Beltran. How about that? On the all-time Met home run list. He's still down on the list, but not bad. I think seventh is where he's at now. But he passes Beltran with his 150th home run. They flashed that note on the scoreboard, and the crowd went nuts. Crowd got really into it. And Lindor saw that, gave a big smile. I don't know if he did a hat tip, more just like a, he felt his cap for a second. But I think, and this is where I'm going to advise my fellow Met fan, you got to get out of the world of thinking that what you see on Twitter or even the callers to sports talk radio is the real world. Because it's really not. Like, I always used to say this about radio, and I say this to younger people that get into radio, and it was said to me back in the day, 1%, probably less, of your listeners call in. And we love the callers. I love the callers. Met a few of them at the game on Friday. So it's not a knock on callers. I think they're the fabric of WFAN, but it's only 1%. And usually what causes you to pick up your phone and call sports talk radio is negativity. So judging the opinion of a fan base based on sports talk radio, which is 1% of the audience, and then Twitter, which is just a freaking cesspool, that ain't the real world. And I say that because most Met fans like Lindor. Most Met fans don't want to trade Lindor. So remember that even though you see these things on social media or you hear these things on sports talk radio, that is not the majority. And I think that reaction on Friday night for Lindor, excuse me, I think that is the majority. Anyhow, we will continue to Rico. Once the Mets make these trades, we will definitely have our series recap Rico sometime Sunday night after the four-game series concludes with the Marlins and this long homestand. And depending on when trades are made, we may pop up some instant reactions. I'm not sure. Kind of, you know, there is a life. There is a weekend. So I would say for all the loyal listeners, be ready for Sunday night leading right into the trade deadline. We'll also have a Rico Bronya on Monday right after the trade deadline is over, giving a recap on what the Mets did or didn't do. We do appreciate you listening and downloading the Rico Bronya. And like I said, to make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the WFAN YouTube page and subscribe to the Rico Bronya podcast wherever you download your podcast. Thank you to Pete Hoffman. It's always impressive when he hosts a show and produces the Rico all at the same time. Thank you very much for listening to another edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.